Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to keep our children truly safe? And in removing all potential for harm, do we deny them the opportunity to learn from their own mistakes, or do we even deny them a part of their humanity? When Amy Fusselman traveled with her husband and two young sons to spend a month with friends in Tokyo, witnessing how a different culture approached child rearing and other aspects of daily life sharpened her insight into the peculiarities of American culture and the choices it makes for us without most of us even realizing them. Author Amy Fusselman writes the Family Practice Parenting column for McSweeney's Internet Tendency. Her new book is called Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Amy, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So some years ago, this friend invited you and your husband and your two sons to stay with her family after they moved from New York to Tokyo. And the invitation alone got you thinking about how different her relationship was than yours, just to space.
Yes, my friend Elena is an extraordinary person, a theater director, and immediately, even on this invitation, I was confronted with a really different approach to space.
Because there was the distance, for one thing, and traveling with two little kids, which, you know, some people really embrace and some people sort of strikes fear into their hearts.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I just, you know, being on the plane for 12 hours with a two-year-old is something that, you know, in most mom conversations, it's not something you're trying to do. And she just, it was a non-issue for her. She really just, why would I even bother worrying about that? It was a great introduction to the entire trip, in a way.
You write that she makes space her plaything, which, you know, when you think about her work as a theater director, it seems to make perfect sense.
Yes, I admire that about her immensely, is that she views space all the time and she's interested in looking at the potential of what can happen in a space. She's very extraordinary that way.
Because so many of us don't even really notice it. It's like the empty stuff between objects.
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, that it's a part of her theater work for sure. And when you think of theater as a way of, you know, activating space or happening in unusual spaces, it makes perfect sense.
So when you were staying with her family in what I gather was a pretty pretty modest-sized home to begin with, and you, like, doubled the population, how did everybody manage personal space and room and privacy and that sort of thing?
Well, it was, you know, I mean, coming from New York City, it's not that we were used to a huge amount of space, but it definitely had that feel of camping. And I think any, if you're a family who's been a guest with another family in their home, it can often feel that way. But the good thing about camping with families is that when you have several children around the same age, it lightens the load for parents in a way. So even though it was chaotic and messy, in many ways it was like an adventure playground itself. It was chaotic. It was messy. It was, you know, there wasn't a lot of good rest. But it was joyful, and we had an amazing time.
I have never been to Tokyo, but I suppose I imagined before reading your book that it would be full of, like, immaculate playgrounds with all the latest examples of design and playground equipment. What you discovered, at least in one place, was very different and really, really interesting. Tell us about Savage Park.
Yes, well, Tokyo just, it certainly does have its share of playgrounds like we would see in the United States, a typical, you know, safety surfaced playground. But the playground that my friend took us to was an adventure playground. And adventure playgrounds are playgrounds that were developed in 1943 by landscape architect Carl Sorensen in the Emdrup section of Copenhagen when that town was under German occupation. And there's three components of them. They are, you know, it's a vacant lot. There are donated scraps or tools or materials, and there's a play worker who's there to facilitate the children's play but not to direct it. And so when I had never seen an adventure playground before, and when she took me to this space, it was really a confrontation to me in terms of, it completely upended what I understood was possible in a children's play environment. And I felt I felt after seeing it that I really wanted to, and my first feeling was just that I wanted to pay homage to it because I was so blown away by it.
What's remarkable is when you describe it, it reminds me a little of the experience so many of us had growing up, like discovering that you were allowed to play in your grandparents' basement or in a neighbor's garage, and there was stuff that maybe you weren't ordinarily allowed to mess with that nobody was there to tell you not to touch.
Yes, exactly. There was a bit of that, you know, just mind-boggling freedom. Like, you've got to be kidding me. This is for us. You know, it was a very heart-opening experience.
There are things there that theoretically could, you know, allow a small child to hurt himself.
Most definitely, yes. There are, you know, open fires. There are hole punches. There are hacksaws. There are hammers. There are sticks and rocks. Things you wouldn't necessarily find in a playground in Central Park.
How did your sons use the space?
Well, they were ecstatic upon first understanding, really, that the tools were there for them to use, and they could scamper up on these structures that were not, you know, fenced or guarded in the way that they were used to. They were ecstatic. We were just sort of stumbling behind them, my husband and I, just trying to keep up, really. And they hammered immediately just for the joy of it, you know, just hammered.
It's always interesting. I've been reading a novel completely unrelated to work about, you know, the work of anthropologists. And we're always sort of surprised in America by different cultures and their openness to allowing a certain degree of risk for young children. And it seems that it doesn't go wrong nearly as often as we in our helmeted and, you know, safety elbow padded society would imagine that it would.
Right. I mean, the playground, and, you know, in speaking with the play worker there, there hadn't been a serious accident of the kind you would imagine in a place like that. You know, is the loss or injury of a child tragic or horrible or something to avoid? Yes, always. It's terrifying. But I do think you're right that there's, you know, there is in our culture, specifically with our culture of litigation, just a lot of red tape and structure around the idea of taking risk for children.
Could you contrast Savage Park with your memory of taking your son for swimming classes in New York?
Yes. My son was in a day camp where they were given swimming lessons, and I was amazed, really, at the kind of military precision around, you know, how they experienced the water, not only with, you know, a lifeguard per small group of child, but, you know, floaters in the pool. And, I mean, it was beautiful in a way how choreographed it was. It was really like a finely tuned machine. And, you know, drowning is the silent killer. I mean, you want that kind of hypervigilance in water. It's true. But, you know, I think that it's not that I chose that image in the book in order to say that it was bad and that Savage Park was good. It's really just to ask questions about how we deal with the risks that we take.
Well, I was thinking about the fact that, and you know, I wanted my kids in a very safe swimming class, too, when they were small, especially if you're not there for every class, right? But there is a fine line between taking away the risk and then taking away that, like, astonishing joy of when you first learn to swim and you're in the one environment on the planet where you can move easily in all dimensions.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that I love about water and water images is that in some ways, the way that most people would describe or experience water is in some ways what, you know, I felt Elena was pushing me towards recognizing about space itself, that it has that kind of, you know, it's a present thing in between. It's not an absence. It's a thing. And in taking, you know, the wire walking class with Philippe Petit, which I discussed in my book, I felt like he was someone who completely is coming from that perspective. I mean, to look at the World Trade Center towers and to see immediately the potential in the negative space, that is a perspective that intrigues me very much.
For people who don't recall, he's the guy who in 1974 strung a cable sort of on the quiet between the two towers of the World Trade Center and walked across. Mm-hmm. What made you want to take his class?
Well, I felt when I saw that they were offering this class, I just felt that I wanted to learn about space from him. I really wasn't that interested in wire walking, and it's not like I'm, you know, some sort of heroic athlete. But I wanted to hear what he would have to say about this, about his perspective on art making. And he is a very interesting artist, and I admire him a great deal. His recent book on creativity, you know, he frames it as a crime. And I think that there's a lot to that, that his notion that that creativity is transgressive. That's not only his experience. I think that's it's true in general.
And I guess it's transgressive because in order to make something that's truly new, you have to know but set aside everything that's come before, even if you're aware of it and it's affecting the way you think. You have to, like, deliberately choose something different?
Well, I think yes. And also just the idea that if you're, you know, creativity is, if you think of innovation really as being creativity that has no boundary, of creativity that's just allowed to unfold without being shut down, I think what happens a lot is that people are creative. But, you know, in general, I mean, history is rife with examples of innovators. They get pushback. That's like the first thing that happens. You know, think of Ulysses. I mean, the reviews for anything, Jackson Pollock, and not to mention all the amazing works by women artists. And it's just, that's part of the game. And innovation is not, you know, is tricky and it's difficult.
So what happens to those works and their significance at the point at which they are accepted into the canon?
Well, I think that's something that's out of an individual artist's control. And what has to happen is that, you know, a creative person has to be dedicated to the work and resilient enough to put work into the culture without being thrown by the pushback. This is actually relevant to issues of the playground, because I feel like, you know, a playground that is safety surface, that's not connected to the environment, that doesn't allow children the opportunity to change it or to experience cause and effect, is in a way, you know, really limiting their creativity and space at a time when we want them to be experiencing that. And that's something that Hanegie Play Park offered.
Yeah, the idea that if you've reduced a playground to being a very safe place where it's only about the sensory experience of, like, moving on a swing or something, it's only half of the whole experience.
Even less than a swing. And Susan Solomon has an important book called American Playgrounds, and in it she provides this image of the McDonald's playground, which is a kind of a playground that really is not, it's endemic to McDonald's, but it's not connected to the environment. And what it's largely consists of is kind of decks and bridges. And so she's quoting an art historian who states that really what the children are doing at the McDonald's playground is kind of, it's almost like a rehearsal for waiting in line for food. It's like running across the bridge, standing, you know, waiting your turn to run to another place. It's kind of shattering when you think about it in comparison to what's possible in something like Hanegie Play Park.
We're speaking this hour with author Amy Fusselman, who writes the Family Practice Parenting column for McSweeney's Internet Tendency. Her new book is called Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Amy Fusselman about her new book, Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Amy, do you have any sense of why it is that it's so hard for adults to play the way we did when we were kids?
I think that's a really interesting question. I am not sure. I can say, though, that I think there's a lot of fear about it, and there's a lot of, you know, playing requires vulnerability. I mean, I can say I quit drinking when I was 23, and I'm like 90 now, but I've had a long time to observe that adult play rituals often involve alcohol. I think in some ways, you know, drinking is a shortcut to the play state, and it's just widely accepted as a sort of easier way to get there.
I guess play happens best even in childhood before we have developed any social inhibitions at all.
I have a 13-year-old now, and I'm still encouraged by the fact that he just lets it rip. You know, he can play seemingly just with total abandon. It is possible, I think. It is possible, but there's so many other intrusions, you know, homework and sports and everything. It's hard.
Do you think that our outsized fear for our children's safety, particularly in this time and this place, is a holdover from the days when nearly every family lost a child or children before they were grown?
I don't know. I mean, I think that in some ways what it is now is that the demands on parents for their time are so great that it's hard for us to really devote ourselves or pay attention to children's play, especially because the idea around it, I think, is that it's sort of something they're going to outgrow. You know, the Brian Sutton Smith writes in his book, The Ambiguity of Play, about this notion of the rhetoric of progress. And he says that the notion that, you know, play is a sort of rehearsal for this adult activity is so dominant that it really makes it difficult for us to have any other understanding of it. And when we do think of it in this way, it encourages us, of course, to have adult intervention in children's play. It's so important. It's their rehearsal. Well, we have to get in there and curate it and organize it and everything else.
And it's hard sometimes to not feel like you know the right way something is to be done. And you became good friends with a woman who actually works as a play like facilitator in one of these parks in Tokyo. And even she, who was like very relaxed about the whole thing, kind of struggled at one point with not, you know, jumping in and telling kids to use paint in a particular way.
Yes, I mean, I was really moved by that interaction that I had with Noriko, who was the play worker at Hanagi Play Park, because it seemed to me that she was, you know, struggling with this teeny tiny intervention, but yet I so admired her for doing that, because I think that the tendency is really in some ways to think, okay, we've padded the playground, there's nothing there that can hurt us, and then to sort of, you know, sit on the bench with our phones. And I think there's a middle ground, you know, between assuming that everything is okay because we've mastered the environment and then also to be helicoptering. I mean, it seems like we're sort of swinging between those two poles right now. And she offered a different model.
You write about an experience you had looking for like a little bathtub ring for your daughter when she was a baby, and they had discontinued the model that you'd used with your sons who were older. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I had bought for my second kid this bathtub ring, which is like a kind of like a scaffolding really for your baby to sit up in the bathtub, and it adheres to the bottom of the tub with a little rubber plastic, you know, gummy things. And I was trying to buy this object again for my daughter because I had given away my son's, and I couldn't find it. The only thing I could find was this updated version of it, which had this giant, like, plastic prosthetic arm on it, and the arm affixed the scaffolding to the side of the tub. It was bizarre, and it made, I mean, when it, you know, the, it just made it this giant, crazy, unwieldy object, which was not really what I wanted in my bathroom, and I didn't understand why it was like this. And so I started to, you know, to Google, and found that there was, you know, the Consumer Union had actually, you know, come down and said that this was an important intervention because adults might be distracted while having the baby in the bath, and therefore we need this sort of plastic thing to make sure the baby doesn't tip forward. And, you know, back to your image of water, it's really that thing of why are we having a plastic arm to keep parents from being distracted? I just was completely taken aback by this, quote, development, which was clearly not, I mean, yes, it's for the baby in a sense, but it's more for us in a way that I question.
Yeah, it made me think about the weird faith that we place in our consumer goods that if we buy the right things, then nothing bad will ever happen to us.
Right, totems, exactly, our safety totems.
And it's just an illusion of control, right? All you have to have in your life is one really bad thing to happen to suddenly realize that you're in control of very little.
Yes, it's painful. I mean, it's hugely painful to realize, you know, how vulnerable we are. It's hard.
The thought I had multiple times reading this book was that the irony is that our fear of dying looks a whole lot in practice like a fear of being alive.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear that that's what you took away from it. I mean, the subtitle of the book, you know, as unwieldy as it is really not about saying you're afraid to die, therefore you can't play properly. That's not it. It's really to acknowledge where we are. It's scary to be alive. Let's just look at that for a minute instead of, you know, heroically buying more prosthetic arm bathtub seats. You know, let's observe it because it's actually affecting a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, nothing on Amazon's going to make you immortal.
Sadly, no. I would be there in a heartbeat.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Steve on the line in Frisco. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I think it's a very interesting subject. I was fortunate enough to grow up overseas a little bit and different perspective on how we play. But I think it's interesting the perception that, you know, we want a no-risk society, but yet, you know, you talked about, you know, we're helmeting our kids and all that, but then we're sending them out there to run into each other, you know, head-to-head playing football, which is, you know, tremendously risky for the kids, especially when they're really young. And we don't perceive that as such a risk that we stop doing that.
What do you think about that, Amy?
Well, I actually, it's bringing me to a point. There's a book by Huizinga called Homo Ludens, which is a book by a, you know, a play scholar, and he really notes that this idea that playing as we think of it, it was written in 1950. What he basically writes is, you think that, you know, sports is the pinnacle of our play culture, but in fact, it's really not playing at all. It's overly serious. There's actually nothing playful at all about professional sports. I mean, and I think that it you've put your finger on in making that observation that that's kind of the zeal, you know, with which we have our children embark on becoming part of the, you know, professional sports system is something akin. It's akin to a military style endeavor. It seems like the playfulness is kind of swept aside.
It's a great point, and it is so regimented, right? The smallest, you know, foot over the line changes everything and sort of, you know, brings a whole set of consequences. And then play, typically natural play, doesn't work that way.
Well, it can be serious, but I can tell you because my kid's on a hockey team that when you're in the stands with the, you know, the parents, it doesn't feel very playful a lot of times. It doesn't feel very playful.
Another amazing experience that you had when you were in Japan was realizing how much different your experiences, your ability to observe the world and different things when you have pretty much no hope of understanding a word of speech?
Yes. I mean, in some ways, I felt that my being so out of my context and my normal context in Tokyo was actually helpful. Again, this was my brilliant friend who threw me in the pool, so to speak. And there was really a lot of benefit to that. Being a little, you know, off my moorings kind of made me see things in a different way, not having to hear speech all the time and to think about what people were saying or what they might be, you know, just conversation that, especially living in New York City as I do, you're just constantly hearing people talk around you. I didn't really realize that until I went to Tokyo, like, wow, I can hear myself think a little bit.
Yeah. Did it change the way you interacted with your environment? Like, was the pressure off? Is that it?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was just this freedom of I don't have to respond to anyone's speech, you know, except my family's or my friends. I mean, I don't have to. And it made me, I mean, who even knew that I was doing that? But I think you do when you're walking in a crowd on 8th Avenue and there's stuff going on all around you and you're hearing snippets of this and that. It's intrusive in a way that I didn't realize until I could unmoor myself from it.
It sounds so liberating, and yet so many people specifically try to avoid being in places where they can't speak the local language, or God forbid, nobody around them speaks English.
Well, I must say that I wasn't like a very good guest, I feel, in the beginning, just in the sense that it wasn't like I was like, hey, yeah, we're coming to Tokyo. I was a little bit reluctant. It was such a giant adventure. It was such an adventure, but it was impossible to say no to it because who would ever be crazy enough to offer that to us again? We had to go.
Was it? And you went for an extended period of time, which, you know, I guess given the distance that you were traveling, made perfect sense. Did you like start to crave personal space and like control over your time in a way that you hadn't anticipated?
Yes, I mean, I do think that. You know, some people are better guests than others, I guess. And there's a whole dynamic to being a guest. You know, you have to surrender your itinerary and your, you know, if your host decides to, you know, take you to X or Y. I mean, I don't know. I just felt like I could engage in a dialogue about it. But I submitted to my friend. I submitted to what she wanted to do. It was part of the arrangement. And I trusted her. You know, it was rewarding, but it wasn't. It definitely was not comfortable.
Has that experience affected the way you act as a host?
Well, I actually hosted Noriko, the woman who was the play worker at Anagi Play Park. She came to visit our family about a year after I had gone to stay with her just to observe the park. And at that time, I was very aware of trying to be a good host, and I tried to not, you know, I tried not to dictate and to do what, just to facilitate. I was actually trying to be a play worker in the sense that I, you know, to facilitate what her desire was, and no matter what that was, you know, she wanted to go see the World Trade Center site, you know, she wanted to do X or Y, and I do think so. When you realize how vulnerable your guest is, I think, after you've been a guest for a while. It's humbling. It's a beautiful experience.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because even if you are good friends with the person that you're hosting, you want to show them what you feel like they're the best thing about your town or your country or your culture. And, you know, that may not be the thing that they're most interested in at all.
Right. I mean, I did let that go. There's certain, you know, not everybody who comes to New York is going to want to see the Book of Mormon, no matter how much I love it. But yeah, she, you know, it was a very good experience. I think it's about surrendering, and I value, you know, what comes with surrender at the appropriate moments. I think it's soul enriching.
Are you a person who finds it easy to do that? I sometimes have to be sort of pushed to get outside my comfort zone, and then I'm always glad I've done it, but I need someone to kind of help me get there.
Oh, no, totally. I hate it. I definitely hate it. I guess that's why, to me, it's fodder for writing, because it's so rich, you know? It's so rich.
And maybe as a writer, I mean, you can get outside your comfort zone, I would imagine, pretty easily, like mentally. So anything physically or in terms of like day-to-day experience just feels like that much more, I don't know, of a not a risk, but of a challenge.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if this as a, for me as a writer, like my ideal day is sitting on the couch. That's definitely true. There's not a lot of risk there, sadly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Christina in Denton. Hey, Christina.
Hi there. Hello. I've got two boys, 5 and 8, and I just wanted to make to share that I just realized why my boys love going to the skate park. I thought I knew part of the reason was, you know, mastering the tricks, but also I think, you know, the adrenaline rush, I guess, that comes with the danger aspect of it. And I've noticed that the overemphasis on our playgrounds and of the safety on our playgrounds. And I just wanted to point out that the skate park is sort of a space that's a good option, you know, for kids to still feel that danger aspect. So anyway, I just wanted to share that, and I had aha moment when I was listening to you that, oh, that's part of why they love going to the skate park, you know. So thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Anything you want to respond to there, Amy?
Yeah. No, I love that. I mean, there's a skate park here in Chelsea Piers, and I love to watch the kids there. It's thrilling. I mean, it reminds me there's a about game design. There's a book called Rules of Play by the game designers Eric Zimmerman and Katie Sallin, and the first thing they address in the book is what is a meaningful action. What is a meaningful action? I was so taken by that this would be coming from a game design book. I really think that game designers are asking the kind of questions that I wish that, you know, the playground designers were able to ask. I don't even think it's not that they don't want to. I don't think they're even able to ask those questions because they're so constrained. And the skate park seems like one place where those kind of questions can be engaged.
My guest is author Amy Fusselman. She writes the Family Practice Parenting column for McSweeney's Internet Tendency, and she's the author of a new book called Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Amy Fusselman about her new book, Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Julie who says, I would love to let my kids play in our safe neighborhood and ride their bikes to school by themselves, but I'm actually afraid of getting in trouble with the authorities.
Does she mean the police? In terms of your kids being found out and about with no guardian? I'm reminded of, there was a police case recently, right, about a mother who had left her child in the playground because she needed to go to work.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know from the email. I mean, I guess the authorities could be the police, and it could also be like a judgy mom down the street or something.
Right, right. Well, certainly, you know, as a mom, there are judgy moms out there. It's tricky. I'm reminded now, too, of the woman in New York City, Free Range Kids. I can't think of her name right now, but she wrote that book. And when she allowed her child to go alone on the subway, there was a huge pushback, you know. I think it's funny. My oldest is 13, and the dialogue that I'm having with a lot of moms, fellow moms now, is, are they old enough to be on the subway? And it seems to be that every family is sort of figures that out by themselves, what the right time is. When is the child ready to go on the bus by themselves? Do they, you know, when do they take the train by themselves? Maybe it's because children today are, you know, they're so organized, they have so little unstructured free time, that these are the new developmental milestones, and that when do we let our kids out and about? I wish I had an answer for her. I don't, except that I think that the fact that she's thinking about it is fantastic, and that I hope that she can find a way to make it happen.
I wonder about some of those things and the way that our culture has changed. And it, frankly, it's a culture of people who are fortunate enough to have options, right? A lot of people, like, you know, you mentioned the mother in the who left her child in the park because she had to go work. I think she was doing like a minimum wage job and couldn't afford childcare. But for those who do have the option, I wonder if it's a question of not trusting that our children are smart enough to make wise decisions and sort of keep themselves alive while they're not in our sight, or if it's a sense that we are so vital, we're such an integral part to their very survival, long past the age at which they really need us next to them 24/7.
Right. And two, there's the idea that, well, if every other mom is, you know, has your child with a sitter for X or Y time, are you going to be the rogue mom who lets them not? You know, speaking of being an innovator and pushback, I mean, can you tolerate making a different decision if you think it's in the best interest of your kid, even if it's different or it might be going against a social norm? That's an interesting question.
Right. And there's always that, like, it's the God forbid that stops you, right? It's the God forbid I make this decision and then one time, you know, a pot catches on fire on the stove or whatever. And then it all comes crashing down.
Right. Right. I mean, they're true risks. That's the bottom line. It's not, you know, it is a risk. I think it's exciting. It's worth thinking about. I love those questions. But to not think about them, I think, and to not ponder them or ask, is it possible, is where the problem is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rachel in Dallas. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well.
I'm mom of two boys, 17 and 19 now. And I did not grow up in this country, but raising my children in this country. And please, I love living here. But one of the things I noticed is once they got to high school, they could not play any of the sports they liked to play because you had to be really good to play it. So there was a tryout. Everything is a tryout. So if you weren't good enough for basketball or football or lacrosse or anything like that, you can't play if you didn't make the team, which was really tough. So you have to go off and find your own way of just playing the game. That just doesn't happen anymore. The other thing, too, is all my friends that come over from Ireland and England had passed a comment to me, which they're not wrong. We would take the dog up to the field with the lead on, throw the ball, and people in the neighborhood get upset. And they said, you know, for a country that's known as the land of the free, there's really nothing very free here. There are a lot of rules.
Oh, that's
and
really
I've lived
interesting.
Here 18 years, and I have to agree, I love living here, but there's a lot of rules and regulations.
What an interesting perspective. What do you think, Amy? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do think that's really interesting. It's especially the idea of the dog being off the leash. I mean, that's a huge issue in Central Park. Dogs unleashed and leashed. It's a cultural bridge. It's always being crossed, and people are offended. And I think again her comment too about what Huizinga called the over seriousness of the sports culture. It's really it's startling. I mean, there was a movement in the 70s, a new games movement of, you know, the games were going to be stripped of their winners and losers, and it was sort of an attempt to try to frame games in a new way. You know, it was something very of the time, but I don't know. You know, the other side of it is there's so many children's field days or whatever where everyone gets a medal. It's again, it seems like there's two poles, you know, the overt seriousness of trying out for junior varsity track or the field day where every child is going to get a medal for showing up. The middle ground is hard.
I guess the reality is that some kids would do better in a world where everybody gets a medal for showing up. And some kids do better in a world where you have to try really hard and compete. And like the pendulum can swing on one side or the other, but it's hard to accommodate everybody.
Right, right. And also I think, you know, you as the parent know your kid the best. I mean, you're trying to navigate some crazy situations, opportunities. You know, what's best for one kid might not be best for the other. Schools have very different approaches. I mean, we have a wealth of approaches in this country, even in terms of education and homeschooling. It's hard to make it to choose.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Veda in Cleburne. Hi, Veda.
Hi. I find this conversation just overwhelming. I've got to get her book. But I actually developed a children's museum in Cleburne now, and parents have thanked me over and over. And I've got an old-fashioned metal slide like I grew up with indoors, a sand underneath of it, monkey bars, and, you know, and we're reopening soon because we're redoing the museum. And, I mean, I tell parents when they come in the door, be aware there's an art room and there's scissors on the table and there's arts and crafts on there. Kids are coming in and they're playing. And there's nothing stopping them. And I'm seeing more parents excited because they're like, I've never seen my kid just play.
That's so phenomenal. Congratulations.
I'm starting to see the change. And people are like, there's never been a place like this ever. And they're like, this is amazing. And I'm starting to see the play. And I've caught more parents going down the slide now than children.
There's no reason the slide's not still fun. They're just not big enough for most adults.
That's exactly right. I love that comment, and I think that's fantastic. I'm reminded of, I was talking actually to my doctor, my general doctor, about my book, and I said this comment, you know, it's about a playground in Japan where children play with fire, and she kind of nodded, and her comment was, well, the fire station must be really busy. And I understood when she said that, as, you know, a fellow mom in New York, that she didn't mean like the fire station, like engine 41, you know, clang, clang. She meant the station, you know, like the station that you see often in a children's museum where, you know, the thing that you're going to experience has been so made small and controlled, you know, that it's going to provide a small experience to like one child at a time. It'll be, you know, supervised by someone in a lab coat. I mean, I couldn't even really tell her. I felt like it was too much to explain to say that wasn't in fact the case.
Well, and, you know, fire was one of those things that I was always nervous when my children were little. And the truth is they're pretty smart and they learn from experience. You touch something hot one time and you're going to remember that and you're not likely to go back for more.
Right. Well, I mean, yes, any burns are not fun. We do not want burns as a parent. You know, that's not a place we want to go. But at the same time, I mean, something that was moving to me about Hannity Play Park was just that, you know, there was a real commitment to this. Children need to experience the four elements. This is a part of being human. They need to know what a fire is like, what it does, how it burns, what burns in it. This is a function of our humanity. I was very moved by that commitment to it.
What did you observe, Amy, about the other parents whose language you couldn't understand as they talked to their own kids? Like, how were they watching their children play? To what extent were they intervening or just sort of sitting back or zoned out?
Well, the thing that I loved most about the park, I have to say, is that it didn't feel like the playgrounds that I've experienced in New York, in the sense of that it was a play space purely for children. There were routinely adults in the play park who were there playing. They were playing music. They were playing recorders. They were playing. There was a lot of music in the play park. There was an old gentleman who would come daily pretty much to work on a woodworking project with the tools. It was very moving to me to experience this cross-generational play, and in a way that it wasn't weird. In that way, the model of the park really reminded me of an art studio. It was that kind of environment of, this is where we can make a mess. This is where we can experiment. This is where we can make stuff, you know, in a way that was very free and open.
It also really flies in the face, to be honest, of the clearly biased, I think, vision that we have of life in Japan and the amount of, like, constant self-discipline that people, you know, hold themselves in. Did that take you by surprise, or was it something that you already understood about this place?
Well, I wondered, I mean, I'm not an expert on Japanese culture, but I did wonder that if it's because of that, you know, regimentation that in some ways the play park was possible. It's not, I mean, there are also adventure playgrounds and, you know, they're widely, interspersed widely in the UK, they're in New Zealand, they're in Australia, they're in Germany. I mean, it's not just Japan. It's sadly, you know, we don't have very many. But I wondered, you know, if something about that made that sort of freeing environment, yeah, if that made it more, you know, possible. I'm not sure.
The other thing, it doesn't come up a lot in the book, but there's this instinct that parents have now, like, to document every moment of every day, every experience, every bite of food, every, you know, coloring page that their kids experience. And I worry sometimes, as great as these are to see, if they aren't like an artificial filter between real life and us.
You mean parents posting things on Facebook of their kids doing artwork or
playing? I guess so. I mean, maybe they're doing it and just maybe there are people doing it and not posting it. But for the most part, I guess that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, the thing that I loved, yeah, about the play park was just also that respect for the weird privacy, the weird secret nature of children's play. I mean, what, you know, Noriko showed me when I was there was this, what looked to me like just a bunch of crap, and that she pointed out to me that this, in fact, was a toilet, that these boys had constructed a toilet. It was like a little piece of bamboo that they had rigged so that they could stand in front of a lookout window that was cut into this cardboard, and they could pee while they were observing the play park. It was astonishing. Her comment was, even in this, you know, sort of secret, wild place, there was a need to make something that was even more secret and even more wild. And I loved that.
Does it feel like art to you when you watch children in the play park?
Yes. I mean, but I'm of the school where I feel that, you know, something happens when we become adults and this idea that we can be artists is taken away. I'm not sure why. You have to really be, you know, kind of ballsy to go out there and say, I'm an artist. And when you're a child, you're encouraged to say this all the time. I'm not sure what, you know, what we get out of that. Art is something super special that can only be made by super special people. I'm not sure.
And it only counts if it costs millions of dollars.
Right, right. And I, you know, it has a lot of issues in it. There's, you know, money, there's class, there's, I don't know. I mean, I consider myself to be an artist. I embrace that perspective. I work, you know, I devote my life to that. It means everything to me. And to see kids making art is fantastic.
Amy Fusselman's new book is called Savage Park, a meditation on play, space, and risk for Americans who are nervous, distracted, and afraid to die. Amy, it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate you making this time for us.
Thank you so much. I love being here. Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.